You owe the bank $100, it's your problem. You owe the bank $1 million, it's the bank's problem. That's the old saw. But here's a new one. American companies owe billions and billions of dollars, which I think makes it all of our problem. From American Public Media, this is Market Class. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 15th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, Sears, filing for bankruptcy protection this morning, as you have heard. Also, of late, Toys R Us, bankrupt. Two rather high-profile victims of an interesting trend in corporate America the past decade or so. Debt. And lots of it. Companies have been borrowing like there's no tomorrow because money's been really cheap. But as interest rates have been edging up, as we've been reporting, at a time when corporate debt as compared to corporate income is the highest it's been in 10 years, well, we had Marketplace's Sabri Benishour look into whether that ought to worry us.
Corporate America has been piling on debt.
Debt to earnings are up a fair amount, no doubt about it.
Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Luthold Group. In 2008, U.S. corporations had 20 cents of operating income for every dollar of debt. Now, they only have 15 cents coming in for every dollar of debt.
In some sense, it's rational compared to the past for companies to have more debt.
That's because interest rates have been so low, and borrowing lets corporations do things like lower their taxes or invest in themselves.
The problem is when there's a lot of debt outstanding and there's a shock to the economy.
Abraham Ravid is professor of finance at Cy Sims School of Business at Yeshiva University. This is the longest economic recovery since World War II. What if there's a downturn in the next few years and companies have to pay that debt back or refinance at a higher interest rate than they had expected?
I don't think it's going to be as massive as what created the first recession with financial crisis, but there are a lot of companies that are at risk.
Matteo Arena is assistant professor of finance at Marquette University. He says a lot of companies are taking steps to protect themselves by, for example, shifting to longer-term bonds that might come due after some brief downturn. Secondly, says Luthold Group's Jim Paulson, companies may have a lot of debt, but many of their customers don't.
Unlike businesses, the consumer sector, for the most part, households didn't really undertake another debt binge.
That should help, too, if there's a downturn. Abraham Ravid at Cy Sims says it's not clear whether or not we should be worried.
Corporate debt is definitely a good idea for corporations, so there is always an optimal level.
Unfortunately, you usually only find out what that level is after a company defaults or declares bankruptcy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
It appears, and we stress here the word appears, that some kind of face-saving resolution is at hand in the disappearance of dissident Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Published reports suggest the Saudi government is going to blame an intelligence operation gone very wrong. They were going to kidnap him, not kill him, it seems. But whatever the cover story does eventually wind up being, one of the many underlying facts in the Saudi-American relationship is that the economic relationship is very close. Here's Marketplace's Justin Ho.
Saudi Arabia buys a lot from the United States. Weapons for its military, for example. John Sfakianakis at the Gulf Research Center in Riyadh says Saudi Arabia also buys American planes, information technology, and it's the 10th largest holder of U.S. debt.
Saudi Arabia traditionally has invested a lot of its reserves in U.S. treasuries.
Saudi Arabia exports a lot of products to the U.S. too. Chemicals, fertilizers, and as you might expect, the big one is oil. The U.S. buys more oil from Saudi Arabia than from any other country besides Canada. Sarah Voxery is the president of SVB Energy International. She says those Saudi exports will be important now that Iranian oil is about to be hit with new sanctions.
Saudi Arabia is the major producer that is going to cover for Iran's oil export. Saudi Arabia has the largest spare capacity in the market, and its crude oil is the closest type of crude oil to Iranian crude oil.
President Trump says he wants to preserve the $110 billion arms deal that he brokered with Saudi Arabia last year. At least so far, that deal hasn't resulted in many new sales. Rachel Bronson is the author of a book about America's uneasy partnership with Saudi Arabia. She says all this makes punishing Saudi Arabia pretty difficult.
Administrations in the past have tied these two countries together in part so that they can't hurt the other without hurting themselves.
She says Saudi Arabia has weapons in its arsenal too, namely its oil exports.
The Saudis can also threaten to tighten their oil exports and make prices even higher.
She says Saudi Arabia would prefer to keep its economic ties with the U.S., but the kingdom could turn elsewhere if that relationship sours. After all, Saudi Arabia's biggest trading partner is China. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Crude oil today, just because it seems relevant, up just a touch, $71.68 a barrel in New York. That's West Texas Intermediate. Bonds, equities, details when we do the numbers. The Brexit news of the day is that the Brits and the EU have made a deal on the terms by which Great Britain will leave the European Union next March. Or maybe they haven't. It's complicated. There are conflicting reports. And anyway, there's a big summit meeting on Wednesday, after which we will know more. Maybe. Much of the attention at the moment, though, is focused on the land border between Ireland, which is part of the EU and staying in it, and Northern Ireland, which is part of Great Britain and thus leaving the EU. But that's not the only intra-EU border that's at issue as the common market comes apart just a little bit. The tiny self-governing British colony of Gibraltar, population 34,000, sits at the southern tip of Spain. It's been British for a very, very long time, but the people of the Rock voted overwhelmingly to stay in the EU and are being dragged out against their wishes. And that could damage, Brexit actually could damage, the territory's very prosperous economy. From Gibraltar, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Every week, a small group of men dressed like 18th century British soldiers march up and down Main Street in Gibraltar. But these redcoats are not the villains of this historical reconstruction, they're the heroes. This display celebrates Britain's capture of the Rock from Spain and the beginning of British colonial rule.
We've been British since 1704. We've been British for longer than the Americans have been American.
And longer even than Gibraltar was Spanish, says leading Gibraltarian lawyer Christian Hernandez.
We have grown up with British traditions. It's not a question of wanting to choose over another, it's just who we are. God save
the Queen. But enthusiasm for British sovereignty, loudly on show at Gibraltar's National Day last month, is also due to economics, says Gibraltar-born journalist Jonathan Scott.
And I think it's largely to do with life being good on the Rock. We've got a lot more spending power than our colleagues and friends just kilometres away in Spain. That is part of the 2018 Gibraltarian identity.
Under Britain's light-touch rule, the Rock has made itself rich with the third highest GDP per capita in the world, a major centre for finance, online gambling and tourism. But recently, the relationship with Britain has taken a nasty turn. Brexit has cast a shadow over the Rock's prosperity.
The big fear is that the border might be closed by the Spanish state with the agreement of the European Union.
Edward McQuiston of the Gibraltar Chamber of Commerce, he says Britain's exit from the EU could embolden Spain to reassert its ancient claim and put pressure on the Rock by closing or restricting a border that's vital to the territory's economy.
Most of our tourists, 8 or 9 million people who come to visit Gibraltar every year, cross the land frontier from Spain to get in here. 40% of our workforce cross that frontier every day to come to work and then go back across in the evening. We import pretty much everything and most of that comes through the frontier.
Oddly enough, there's just as much worry about Brexit just across the border here in the frontier Spanish town of La Linea. Juan José Uceda orders drinks in a social club set up here for Spanish workers in Gibraltar. Uceda represents many of the 13,000 people who live here in Spain but earn their living across the border. He says the impoverished town's economy is utterly dependent on the Rock.
Gibraltar is as important as life itself.
If La Linea were a table, he says, two of the legs would be Gibraltar.
If those two legs break for Brexit or whatever, the table will, La Linea will collapse.
You really need Gibraltar.
We need Gibraltar.
He's happy for Gibraltar to remain British, but admits the overwhelming majority of Spaniards want to recover the territory.
The Rock of Gibraltar rises majestically from the sea at the entrance to the Mediterranean.
Back on the Rock, business is booming at tourist sites and in online gambling and financial services. All this could suffer as Gibraltarians are dragged out of the EU against their wishes. But Edward McQuiston doesn't believe the Rock will soften on the issue of sovereignty.
We want to remain British. And if that means we have to leave the EU, if that means that we have to take an economic hit, then so be it.
He can draw some comfort from Gibraltar's own colony of Barbary apes, the only wild monkeys in Europe. Legend has it that as long as they remain, British rule over the rock will continue. And the apes have been breeding like crazy. In Gibraltar, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are, in this trade war we're still having with the Chinese, hard quantitative things each side can do. Tariffs themselves are a good example of those. 10 or maybe 25% import taxes on a whole list of goods shipped by each side to the other. Also, softer, more qualitative things, like just not buying certain things the other country sells. And for our purposes right now, one of those certain things is American oil, which China has basically stopped buying. Rebecca Elliott covers energy for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This seems like a substantial drop in Chinese imports of American oil. What is going on?
So as the trade tensions between the U.S. and China have escalated in recent months, even though China has not imposed any tariffs on U.S. crude, the U.S. exports to China actually dropped to zero in August after about 350,000 barrels a day of crude in the first half of the year. So a very significant drop.
And we're reasonably sure that it's all trade related, right? They just decided we don't want to buy this stuff anymore. We're going to get our oil elsewhere.
Right. So it may be that Chinese companies are kind of looking to limit purchases of U.S. oil in case the trade tensions escalate further. And, you know, let's say tariffs were imposed on crude.
Sure. We should point out here that it's not like the global market is an unwelcome place for oil exporters. So American crude does have somewhere to go.
Yes, exactly. The first week of this month, actually, U.S. crude exports neared 2.6 million barrels a day. Yeah. So they're at kind of record highs in recent months. So what we're seeing is a shift in the trade pattern. So with China not buying as much U.S. crude, that oil is going elsewhere in the world.
So who is buying American oil if the Chinese have decided that they don't want 380 or whatever it is, 1,000 barrels a day?
The U.S. has customers around the world. You know, oil is going to Europe, it's going to Latin America, to India, elsewhere in Asia. The market is shifting in response to this decision on the part of Chinese companies rather than evaporating in any way, at this point, at least for U.S. exporters.
So this is one of those things that it's not a direct retaliation, right? It's not imposing new tariffs on American products. It's the Chinese saying, oh, okay, fine. We're just not going to buy American oil because we don't have to.
Exactly. So there are other exporters. They're exerting that choice. Right. As of right now, it does not appear to be significantly cutting into the demand for U.S. oil. But China has a large degree of buying power, of course.
Right, right. Rebecca Elliott, writing on energy, oil and gas for the Wall Street Journal. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
So we'll get lots of chicken, lots of pork. We'll get lots of fluid milk.
Unexpected winners in the trade war. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 89 points on this Monday, 0.3%, 25,250. The NASDAQ lost 66 points, 0.8%, 7,430. The S&P 500 dipped 16 points, that's 0.5%, 2,750 there. Netflix and Amazon helped drag the NASDAQ south. Netflix down 1.8% ahead of its quarterly earnings report. Amazon down 1.5%. We heard from Justin Ho about threats to the economic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia over the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. Defense contractors are among the companies with a lot at stake. Raytheon gained 0.3% today. Lockheed Martin found 1.1% itself. Tough go for home builders lately. They'll be looking for signs of hope this week. Housing starts, existing home sales, and building permits data are all a-coming. Meanwhile, today, Toll Brothers dropped 0.7%, Lennar down 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to do a life insurance story now that's a little bit haunting is not a terrible word here. Jack Lowry has a piece in The Atlantic magazine called "The Gay Men Who Have Lived for Years with Someone Waiting on Their Death." The story starts in the late 1980s in the advertising pages of the Gay Men's Lifestyle magazines. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Give me some sense of the advertising sections of these gay lifestyle magazines. What were they like?
I mean, they were as varied as any magazine today. I mean, you had advertisements for alcohol, advertisements for designer clothing. You had advertisements for, you know, vacations, cruises. Hmm. And you also had advertisements for viatical settlements.
Okay, so now you have to tell me what viatical settlements were.
In a viatical settlement, a person names a third unrelated party as the benefactor to their life insurance policy in exchange for immediate cash. So if you have a $100,000 life insurance policy and you want to viaticate it, I'll give you 70 cents on the dollar, and you'll name me as the benefactor to your life insurance policy. And so when you die, I'll collect, you know, the entire $100,000.
The catch, of course, is that you're waiting around for me to die.
Yes.
Is there, I mean, life insurance is a regulated industry, right? Is there anything that regulates these viatical settlements?
Not really. Kind of one of the more gruesome parts of the industry is that, especially during the AIDS epidemic, this was not something that was regulated. I mean, some of the brokers who were buying up viatical settlements, you know, I'm sure had, you know, the best interest in mind for these people, but there were a certain amount of pariahism.
Right, because in theory, it's a quick buck, right? I mean, the life expectancy of these men who had AIDS in the 80s and 90s was not long.
No, it wasn't.
Until medicine got involved.
Yes. In 1995, a class of drugs called protease inhibitors came to market. Protease inhibitors dramatically expanded the life expectancy for people living with HIV. Nowadays, the life expectancy for an HIV-positive person is just a couple of years short of an HIV-negative counterpart. And basically, the entire industry around viatical settlements collapsed.
Wow. And so they, with these men now living, you know, some of them from those days, many of them are still alive.
Yes.
And the policies are being paid by?
There isn't really a way to find out who owns your life insurance policy once you sell it. And so the men that I talked to who viaticated their policies in the 90s, they don't really know who owns their policies today.
Which must somehow be terrifying in some weird way.
I don't think it's constantly on their mind, but I think it's something that they definitely do think about from time to time. One of the people that I interviewed is a guy named Sean Strube, and he is the mayor of his town in Pennsylvania. So he is somewhat of a public figure.
Yeah, with some weird kind of price on his head?
With somebody waiting
for him to die.
If they've been paying the policy premiums all these years.
What did these men do with the money they got?
The answer to that is varied. You know, hospital bills were exorbitant for people living with AIDS. The only available medication for a long time was a drug called AZT. It cost $10,000 a year. It was the most expensive pharmaceutical ever brought to market. But two of the men that I spoke with actually started their own businesses. One, Sean Strube, started a magazine called Pause, which is still around today. It's a magazine designed for people living with HIV. One of the other guys that I talked to, Henry Scott, started his own media company that's based in Los Angeles.
It's interesting. It's a story that's a legacy of what feels like another time, if that makes sense.
Yes.
You know, but with ramifications that are playing out today.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sense of regrets that the folks you talked to have about maybe selling those policies? Or do they need the money in the moment and that's what they did?
Neither of the men that I spoke with had any regrets about this. They both said it was the best financial decision they've ever made.
In that moment and to this day?
My sense of it is that, yes, you know, they were able to access large amounts of cash that they would have never otherwise been able to realize.
Jack Lowry, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a whole raft of farmers we talked to on this program. We got a corn farmer, a hog guy, a chicken guy, apples too, out of Washington State. And every time we've talked to him in the past couple of months about American tariffs on Chinese imports and then the retaliatory Chinese tariffs on American exports, a lot of which are agriculture, they say they need those exports to make the businesses work. And even when the White House announced back in August it was going to offer $12 billion in farm aid to mitigate some of those losses, they said they would much rather just have the market work. About a tenth of that $12 billion is going to go to buying crops that probably would have been sold to China. But now that food, well, kind of needs a home. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports that food banks across the country are getting a welcome but very sudden donation.
Dave Richens runs the United Food Bank in Mesa, Arizona. Every year, the center feeds almost 500,000 people in a five-county area east of Phoenix.
We keep everything here about 10 degrees above zero, so it's nice and chilly in here.
Richens walk-in freezer and coolers have a lot of space right now, but not for long. Most years, the center distributes about 20 million pounds of food. But this year, it's going to have even more. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is buying more than $1 billion worth of food from farmers who are losing sales because of the retaliatory tariffs. Those apples, cranberries, lentils, and other goods are getting redirected to food banks and other nutrition programs around the country.
So we'll get lots of chicken, lots of pork. We'll get lots of fluid milk. It's cold. Let's get out of here.
Richens is the first to say this is a great thing for the 40 million Americans dealing with food insecurity. But that doesn't mean it'll be easy. His food bank is expecting to get almost 4 million more pounds of food this season from the tariff program and an unusually bountiful harvest. All of it will require extra money for transportation, fuel, and storage. Richens is seeking $350,000 in new donations to help with increased logistics costs.
Some of the food banks are worried that they might not be able to accept all of the food that might come their way because they can't afford to pay additional truck drivers, lease the trucks.
Carrie Calvert is with Feeding America, a national network of food banks. The organization estimates added distribution demands will cost food banks $300 million in all. So Feeding America is trying to help member food banks find the money. Greg Ibaugh is undersecretary for marketing and regulatory programs at the USDA. He says there's some money the department can use, but calls this an opportunity for public-private partnerships.
We don't anticipate asking Congress for any funds to be able to accomplish our goals.
As for how long the increased supplies might last, Ibaugh says,
we're hoping that by this time next year, when the 2019 crop is being harvested, that we won't need to talk about any additional assistance program.
But even if this program is one and done, Feeding America's Carrie Calvert says this year's spike in supplies has food banks wondering how they can keep inventories higher in the future.
We will need to actively look for ways to replace the food so that we can continue serving families in need.
But for now, groups like Dave Richens United Food Bank are focused more on the short term.
Doesn't really sound like you're too worried about this.
No, we're really worried about it. Are you kidding? This is going to be a lot of work. And the first month or two might be a little rocky, but I think we're up to the challenge.
If everything goes as planned, that could be about 3 million additional meals for this region alone. In Mesa, Arizona, I'm Brett Jaspers for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's a sad one. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen has died. The cause was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's according to a statement from Vulcan, Allen's holding company, issued on behalf of his family. Allen left Microsoft decades ago and in the time since has been a major philanthropist in biomedicine, exploration, also in the arts. He was a big sports guy, too, professional sports in the Seattle area. He owned the NFL Seattle Seahawks, the Seattle Sounders Football Club, also the Portland Trailblazers of the NBA. Paul Allen was 65. Okay, we are out of here. The Dow off 89 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ down 66, that is 0.8%. S&P 500 dipped 16 points, about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Kate Linesh is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.